Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Spiritual Practices and Mindfulness, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Yekir Englander, and I'm talking today with Stefan Fulder, the author of Wakefulness in Daily Life, published in Hebrew by the Pardes Publishing House in 2016, and in English as What's Beyond Mindfulness, Waking Up to This Precious Life in 2019. What is the power and significance of mindfulness and similar practices in conflict zones and conflict situations? Does a person need to challenge the norms and authority of the society and the attachment to nationality in order to seriously meditate? Is it possible to teach meditation and still encourage young people to serve in the military? What are the challenges and at the same time the opportunities of mindfulness for people who suffer from PTSD? Is it possible to believe in the power of a Buddhist-inspired spiritual practice, such as mindfulness, while being a believing Jew? And how should one distinguish between religion and the culture created around it? These are some of the questions that we spoke in this podcast. Stefan Fulder is the founder of and senior teacher of the Israel Insight Society, Tovana, the major organization in Israel teaching Buddhist meditative practice. He has also worked since 1975 in the field of herbal and complementary medicine as an author, consultant, and researcher, publishing many books and research papers. Stefan, let's go deep into the meaning of teaching mindfulness in a conflict zone. How do you became involved as a British person who lives now in Israel with both with mindfulness, and how do you teach it in a place that holds so much conflict, pain, and suffering?
If it's okay, let's dive in. And I want to take a few examples of things that are coming to me as someone who, you know, is a beginner of practicing mindfulness, but it's coming again and again. I'm thinking about myself as an Israeli who needed to go to serve in the military, serve in combat for years. I think about my Palestinian brothers and sisters that are dealing with hard questions. They feel that they need a country, a state. Now, when people do meditation, there is at least a feeling that the ideal is that someone who do meditation and understand that by clinging to something, you actually just create more suffering. The work that you need to do is give up your Palestinian wish for a country. Why do you need a country? Why do you need politics? Like, just leave, be there. Or for the Israelis, it's like, why do you go to serve in the military? Like, how can I be in the paratroopers? How can I be in a combat and shoot when I every day start my morning with meditation and mindfulness. How do you do it in Israel and Palestine?
Yeah, I think it's we have to be careful not to jump to statements about what the fruit of mindfulness is as a belief system, and come back like it, really into the nitty-gritty of what is mindfulness, what its values are, what its purpose is, and where it can take you. So mindfulness does not lead you to a place where, because one of the end games of mindfulness is letting go of attachment to what is, therefore you have to believe in it at the beginning and say from the beginning, oh, it doesn't matter about peace. It doesn't matter because I accept things as they are. Isn't that what the Buddha said? Shouldn't I just be mindful and say, instead of actually making change, just be mindful and leave things as they are? And the Buddha did not say that. And that, I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of mindfulness. Mindfulness is a much bigger field than just paying attention. And it has values. And the values include, for example, if we are awake to the experience of us and of others, mindfulness brings us to be intimate with our experience and other people's experience, because we are the same as others. Yakir, I'm the same as you. Like you, I don't want to die. Like you, I don't want to suffer. You know, you and I are the same. We're two people talking right now, but the empathy comes because of some affinity between us. The same way mindfulness will show us what's behind the eyes of the other, what the other suffers, how the other suffers. When you experience that more and more, it will change your ability to function as a soldier and shoot the other who you feel is yourself. The other, you know, the other suffers, so you will not shoot the other so easily. Maybe you still make a decision, I cannot help it, I have to do this, there isn't a choice. But still, the whole thing will be opened, and hopefully you will be a much, much more effective soldier. We're not making harm unnecessarily, and maybe stopping your colleagues from abusing their position as a soldier, because you feel in your heart the connection with the other, you feel compassion and awareness and sensitivity and all of that growing from your mindfulness practice. As a Palestinian, you can say, we suffer, brothers and sisters of mine, we are suffering. I will do mindfulness in the morning, but the mindfulness will help me to get up in the morning and do the right thing for all of us. The right thing may be call for independence as a state, or the right thing may be have a cup of chai in peace and quiet in the morning, because we also need to do that. whatever it tells us, it tells us. But it certainly doesn't tell us to be passive and resigned and giving up. And there's a very interesting sutta or text. By the way, the mindfulness that I practice and I teach is really based on a big teaching, which is... I suppose you could say the early Buddhist teaching, and not so much filtered through history, either history of the Theravada Buddhist countries, like the text, the derivative texts with much, much detail and a little bit obsession in Burma, for example, or the Tibetan practice, which is itself, you know, hugely culture based on Tibetan culture. And by the way, this is something we can go into. Mindfulness itself is hugely culture adapted to the West. And we have a new vehicle called just like Tibetan Buddhism, we now have Western. So it's something we can talk about later.
Oh yeah, we will come to that.
Yeah, but I just want to say there's a very nice little text that just before the Buddha died, he gathered his monks together and said, monks, be an island. Be an island in the stormy seas. Stand your ground. Don't be overwhelmed by the storms of life. Don't be drowned by the waves. Stand your ground, autonomy, independence. And how do you do that? With care and attention to what are the real bases of your life. I'm breathing. My thoughts are like this. My feelings are like this. My body is like this. The world is like that. Our direct meeting with the world and ourselves as it is helps us create a basis. And that base helps us stand our ground in the face of any kind of challenge, including peace and war.
Thank you for that. I also really loved the connection that you bring with your teachings for trauma of the past. So in the past years, we have more and more research and discourse around the place of trauma that happened to us and the relationship with the body, right? In a way, the trauma is the narrative and the pain is in our body. And it's not only the trauma of us, but also trauma of less generations that is calling us to heal or to do something with that. And I wonder if you bring a beautiful story about a woman who suffered terribly at the Holocaust as an example, and she could feel relief for the first time when she is doing, when she's practicing mindfulness. I wonder if you can share with us a little bit more about this place of trauma and the body. I wonder also in practice, what do you suggest students to do when, because they are in quiet, all these voices and all this pain who are in our mind, but also in our body is like, oh, thank you for being quiet from your life. So now listen to us. And they start screaming. How should we lead that?
Mm. Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, let me say that very powerful trauma, that means trauma that's really engraved in the body system. For example, we get plenty of soldiers, like you were serving as a soldier. We get today plenty of soldiers that come to us with PTSD, post-trauma. And there's a really powerful, almost like an inbuilt pathology that needs some special attention. It is not in the territory of ordinary mindful practice. It needs a more expert understanding because it's very strong. And so, for example, when we get people like soldiers who are suffering from post-trauma, we tend not to tell them to go inside too much and kind of delve in to the inner voices that you talked about, the inner trauma, because that can actually exaggerate it, that can actually give it more space, give it more room, and they can. So instead of that, we try and help them to have new resources. For example, the community, we have to be engaged with the community. If they're on a retreat, we ask them to work in the kitchen, to talk, not to be in silence, not to dive in under the waves too much, because they meet stuff there, they'll meet monsters there that they're not ready to cope with. They shouldn't dive in the ocean, they'll meet the monsters there. So instead of that, we try and encourage them to enjoy life, to feel life as a resource, to sit under trees, to go walking, to talk to us, to enjoy the morning, the sunrise in the morning and the sunset in the evening, and to feel that basically their health and their aliveness. So that's a little different from the classical mindfulness. When we're talking about the trauma, which is less, psychiatric, which is kind of most of the human population, actually, many. The world of mindful attention can really help. And the way it works is this: by paying attention authentically to what arises without censorship or without trying to dress it up, or without pouring perfume on the shit. But we allow the arising of memory and the arising of pain and the arising of past trauma, whether it's yours or whether it's your parents or whether it's your communities. We allow it because it's part of the voices that are authentically seen. And the practice is firstly to acknowledge that this is a voice in me and it's all right. It's not a mistake. It's not I'm a cripple. It's not that I'm singled out as a victim, and it's just a voice bearing painful memory, experience, whatever, even in the body. Allowing it, trusting it, meeting it head on. But the key is to meet these voices as a bit unwelcome, but a bit unpleasant, that can't dress them up, as visitors, that visitors that knock on the door and come in and make a mess in the room. They're not the nice ones. They're not the, you know, the angels. They're a little bit demons. They come in, they knock at the door, and they come in and they're not so pleasant to meet, but they're still visitors and they're still our stories, and we allow them to be there and then to go. And slowly, slowly, seeing them as visitors that come and go, we develop a relationship with them which is much more independent, much less controlled by them. They are visitors in present moment, in real time, that turn up and go. They are partners in our life. They are part of our inner face, you could say, the shape of our body, their inner face, yes, but slowly, slowly, we can feel our freedom with those voices. So that's the whole journey, is not to shut them up and not to dress them up, but to feel our innate freedom along with the voices as well. And when we do that, slowly, slowly, they actually do get less, because we don't give them the space. The Buddhist word for attachment, upadana, is feeding. It's a very interesting language there. What do we feed? So if we don't feed them, like if we don't circle around them like a moth around a flame and feeding the story and feeding the story about, oh, I feel suffering, oh, I feel so bad, oh, it's so terrible, oh, we have to do something about it, oh, on and on and on, and revenge and anger, and I hate those, and they're the evil ones, and so on and so on and so on, building story, building views, and going around and around it. That's feeding it. And non-feeding it would be, yes, it's there. I acknowledge it. I give it its room that it asked for. I let it in through the door and I watch it come and go. And it's part of my life, but it doesn't dominate my whole inner life.
I love the description of the visitor. There is a genre of stories in the Hasidic, which is one of the Jewish mystical genres, about people who are in their journey of growth, and always there is a time when someone from heaven sent them a visitor who is going to make a whole mess in their house. And it's so interesting the way how you put it, because I think that maybe for the first time I really understand what's happening in the story, is that it's not so sweet and they behave nice, because they need to do two things on the same time. One is to be very kind and to tell to the other, you know, children that this person suffered a lot. But on the same time, they need to remember that the guest is not them. And the guest, even if they stay for a while, at one point they will go. Maybe they will come back, but they also will go. And there is always at the end of the story that as a result of this journey, they got a new baby, like they get something which is, you know, a new thing that they didn't meet before as a result. And I think that you really gave me the language how to look at that. So thank you so much for that, Stephen.
Yeah. Rumi has a poem called The Guest House, very well known in the and the bottom line of this poem is these guests, give them space because they are teachers bringing you a message from beyond. Your pain is a teacher giving you a message from beyond. And here, I think, I love the story in the Bible of Job. The journey of Job, it's so much like the journey of the Buddha. And it's because he faced with suffering he couldn't understand. And just exactly like the Buddha, he went on a life journey to try and understand the nature of suffering, which came out of the blue, just like the Buddha. Buddha did it in one night. Job, it happened to him kind of unexpectedly. But both of Buddha and Job were persistent, saying, I will not just accept drown in the suffering and turn miserable, but I will use it as a vehicle and a search for real meaning and liberation in life. And both of them, Job and the Buddha, at the end of their search, received the big teaching of, shall we say, the beyond or the ultimate. And the beautiful language of Job is not so different from the beautiful language of the Buddha, describing what it's like to be awakened. In the end of the book of Job, he just says, you know, God showed me that the reality is the whales dancing and the hawk on the wind and the birds flying in the air, sort of so beautiful poetry. That is what the reality is. But he needed the journey through suffering to experience the bigness of everything behind everything.
Yeah, yes. I wonder when we speak about that, if you can help us also, because many times people who come to mindfulness, mostly when we come, you know, in the middle of the of life, because we don't, I mean, maybe we have, but I don't know many people who grew up into families of mindfulness. I'm sure they exist. I just, in most seminars and, you know, and retreats, it's people who meet it during their life. I wonder if you can speak a little bit about repairing what we left behind. Because one of the things that really bother me with the Buddha is that he had life before, he left this life. It's like almost reborn. I'm asking all the time, what's happened to this poor wife? I mean, when in the stories he's coming back to ask forgiveness, and I always compare the story of the Buddha and my anger towards the Buddha, to Talmudic, which is another genre in the Jewish tradition, where you have huge critique on rabbis who left home to study and to have their relationship with the divine, but they left home, and at the end of the day, when the wife there, she shed a tear, the rabbi died. Which means you cannot play, I'm a newborn, I'm spiritual now, you know, and leave fire behind you. So I wonder if you can walk us into that.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice a nice question, actually. And in some way or other, the Buddha, you know, there was a dysfunctional family there. I think that the whole thing has had a lot of rewriting. And rewriting by males. And I think that's one of the great difficulties of the Buddhist teaching, and perhaps all religious teachings are so patriarchal, nearly all, not all, but nearly all are so patriarchal, and the men have done the rewriting of the texts. And there's very, very touching stories and texts about Buddha's son that he and Buddha's wife that joined the community. And the Buddha invited his wife and invited his son to join them, and they did join. But I acknowledge completely that he may have caused lots of pain, and this isn't dealt with in the tradition. And I don't think, I think that it's partly the male religious kind of ownership of religion, that as the Buddhist world suffers from it, but so do all other religious. I mean, they burnt 9 million witches in the medieval time. Oh, yeah. You don't hear them burning priests or you know, witches, female, often old women.
Right.
There is a story here which is very painful, and we have to be very sensitive to it. The Buddhist community still today is suffering from that, with a male-dominated many monasteries. A new monk that just arrived one day will be in front of the female nuns that have been there 20 years. And it's not acceptable in my view. And I don't think it's also what the Buddha taught. Because in the text itself, the Buddha was asked these things. And at the beginning, he was a bit confused in a way. The text says, well, I suppose people asked him, well, can women be as enlightened as men? And is there a difference? He said, actually, no. You're a human being, and you can go on the journey. But he was subject to his culture, and the culture is patriarchal culture. So he was a little bit reluctant. And today, it's the same story in the religious culture, whether it's Buddhist or Christian or Jewish religious culture. The Dalai Lama, the one time I've seen him cry in a film is when someone asked him about the role of women in the Tibetan culture, and he cried and he said, you know, we have a big weight of history and I wish I can change it, but I can't change it overnight. And he cried. Mm-hmm. When I was in the monastery in Amaravati in England, I asked the monk, the abbot, about this, and he said, look, we are changing, and what I'm doing is not to insist on these rules anymore. If a monk wants to go in front, fine, but if a female nun wants to go in front of the queue or stand in front, I will not say no. I will let things, but it's really, really hard to shift the tradition in 5 minutes.
Right, right. And I think maybe this is one of the gifts that we see in religions in America, and also maybe in the Buddhist tradition, that we see more and more women who are Western, and they are one of the top teachers, you know, and
That's completely right. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about Western Buddhist practice, that we have now a new culture, just like Buddhism came into Tibet with people who just were practitioners and wise guys and wild guys that actually went into Tibet and brought this teaching. And then it developed around it a kind of shell of cultural history of the Tibetan culture. The same thing happened in the West and is happening. It's only arrived in the West about 60 years or so.
Right.
When I started, I was one of the first, along with a few pioneers, who brought the teachings. I don't mean intellectual texts or translation of texts. That's been going on for 100, 150 years, Buddhist texts have been translated into English and so on. But real practice has only been going around 60 years or so. And what happened is mindfulness became the flag of the whole Buddhist teaching. Well, that's fair enough. I don't have a problem with that, because it has to start somewhere. And then mindfulness has turned into this huge, huge, huge institution, practice and so on. It's gone into the British Parliament. It's gone everywhere. But all the rest of the teaching, which is vast, is waiting for us there. And it's dripping in slowly, slowly, but it's still on its way. It hasn't reached. And so the kind of foot in the door is mindfulness, but all the rest is waiting out there. And I've written about this. I've got books about this myself.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. I think the next thing that we're seeing now is also to have Buddhist teachers and mindfulness teachers who are from the LGBTQ community. Question around race is becoming more and more important and getting voices. And I hope that as the West got a lot of gifts by the gifts of mindfulness, also something in this mixture, in this new soup that is happening here, will also give gifts outside around that.
Yeah, I want to just a small story about that. I've tried to teach Palestinians and mindful practice and so on. I realized that there is a very Western Anglo-Saxon psychology-based language that is connected with the way the Buddhist teachings arrived in the West. So I had one time 60 Open University Palestinian students. I was in Nablus, and they said, "Oh, please teach us meditation." I said, "Okay," and I started. And you know, I talked about the body and the breath and the awareness, and they were looking at me with open eyes, as if like to say, "What the hell are you talking about? I don't understand anything you're saying." So I stopped, and I realized it wasn't working. And so I asked them, "What is your images of deep quiet? Mm. What? Tell us. What are your images of deep quiet?" And they said, "Oh, you know, our Arab culture is the culture of the desert. We have the quiet of the desert. We have the quiet of the palm tree, or the tree in the middle of the Khan, the Arab architecture. It's so with walls around and a lemon tree in the middle, or the date palm. And they come in our dreams, and they're part of our culture. We know silence." And I said, "Oh, good. Okay, let's start with that." And I gave them images, and through the images, they could really practice. They could develop a kind of a inner space. They could dive into inner space using the springboard of something that's culture based to their culture. And it hasn't really happened actually in the Islamic world significantly yet, but it has in the Judeo-Christian, Western, Anglo-Saxon, modern world. It has come, but not yet in the Islamic world.
Thank you. So I want to stay one more for a little bit more with around the question of gender and sexuality. One of the things that we know after Freud is that when you do sex, and if you bring so many layers of who you are, right? It's not only a physical act, it's not only a mental act, is an act that involves imagination unconsciously, etc., etc. It's a whole mess that is coming. And I wonder, because of the way how we look at mindfulness, or more specifically at Buddhism, that the highest teachers are monks, I wonder how much this tradition actually do not let us to have good sex. I don't know how to say it in a better way. It's like, what about lust? What about BDSM? What about like good sex? Mm. And when I think about that, and when I think about my mindfulness life, there is disconnection in the way how it is taught to us. And something in your book, I felt create connections. You didn't run away. As I said, I love, one of the reasons that I love the book is because it feels for me very real. And you let us to stay with the real, you let us to stay with the shit, but also with the desires in a way. I wonder if you can walk with us about this tradition that became very monastic in a way, and also where the place of desire and attachment.
Yeah, sure. So it's true. Again, we're talking about a historical process that in the it actually started with the Buddha. The Buddha said to householders, if you really want to practice, you need to be celibate, and you need to leave the household, and you need to leave your ordinary life. And the reason is that the amount of real deep inner practice that needs you to devote yourself 24 hours and going into very subtle places in the consciousness, it just doesn't go with being swept by desires and busyness and struggle. You need to step out, to go out of that in order to really, really dive in to a spiritual journey. So that has been a standard statement In most, you think of the Christian monks, you think of the Desert Fathers, you think of the religious. And they're not so much in the Jewish world. The Jewish world tend not to do this.
The rabbi is described as people who are not very sexual. It's not there.
Yes. So that's the origin of it. And it then became institutionalized, and the monks became culturally the leaders of the Buddhist faith and the teachers of the Buddhist faith. And unfortunately, they also got the status. And we see it really, really, we see it today in Burma, for example, Myanmar. It creates tragedy as well, where the monks have the status. And so the government recruits some of the monks to support them, and the monks give them status and reward, and they have a deal between them. So it's the same, and I think, with the Christian Church, with the popes and the bishops and so on, that were all celibate. I think that has been a historical cultural movement that is being also abandoned in Western Buddhist teaching, because the Buddha was asked, can a householder with a family, having sex, making children, can he reach enlightenment? And the Buddha said yes. Maybe more difficult, maybe it needs more of a struggle, because it's in a way easier to go on a permanent retreat and just cut yourself off. Maybe it's easier, but it's certainly not. And the Tibetan lamas are often married and have partners. So it's changed now. The Western Dharma, the Western Buddhist teaching, doesn't really hold that anymore, and doesn't put monks the number one. The major teachers in the West are people like myself or Jack or Christopher Titmus or Joseph Goldstein or others who are family, who enjoy sex. And so looking at the teaching itself, there isn't a teaching that says you mustn't have desire. You mustn't, that desire is toxic. What there is when the desire takes over and occupies the mind and begins to take over more and more territory in inner space, then you are attached, you are stuck, and it kind of draws you away from the devotion to something bigger than what your body asks, what your body needs, or what your mind needs today or tomorrow. The neediness and the way it occupies more and more space in the mind is the problem. But natural, ordinary desires, in other words, when you're hungry, you eat. When the Buddha was hungry, he went out to the village and got food. When a householder is sexually triggered, there's nothing about male, female. It has to be a male, female. It doesn't matter. It's desire is desire. So there's nothing basically wrong with a desire that arises naturally and then is satisfied or not. And you're independent and free. And if it's not satisfied, you're also free. If you don't get lunch, you're also free. If you don't have sex, but you have desire, which is unfulfilled, you're also free. You don't turn it into a story or a problem or build anything around it or doesn't destroy your life. So natural desire that is brings to fruition and becomes satisfied or not is not seen as the real issue, and is actually it's worked with a small caveat that sexual life has to be very respectful. That means that the respect for another human being is key here, that you cannot, for the sake of your desires, abuse another, use another, or treat another as your tool or your agent to for your satisfaction. So that's one of the no-nos, but not sex itself. The abuse inside sex, that's a no-no. But natural desire, including sexual desire, is not a problem as long as it's, you know, just natural and coming and going just as hunger or any other natural desire. We need it for our life. Without it, we won't have children. We won't eat.
But I think even a little bit, I wonder, and this is the places that I'm still stuck, and I want to ask you in this opportunity. There is an ability to look at food when I'm hungry. I'm hungry, so let's eat. There is also a decision to dedicate a half day in order to create a gourmet meal because you want this delicious, you want to touch the dip, you want to experience yourself in a new way. I have a desire for sex, let's have sex, with, of course, with respect and consent, no question. But there is also life that it's a style of life of people who says, I want to explore who I am by meeting the other in sexual communication. Like, I see the other in a different way when I go to this journey. And I wonder how much the tradition that you teach invite us to go to these journeys, to go and explore. It's like, don't only meet, there is something even with the fact that we sit, that you meet yourself, or when, you know, you meet your inner life. Also, when we do walking meditation, at the end of the day, you are very much inside yourself. I wonder what's the invitation to go and explore and how I can do it with mindfulness.
Yeah, I understand. I think that the answer might be a little bit challenging what you said just now. Is it really necessary? That could be an answer that comes from mindfulness. In other words, what you're saying is you're doing walking meditation and you really, really want to explore your relationship to this amazing, amazing flower that you see in front of you that is so excruciatingly beautiful, and you want to really explore it. Mindfulness will say, yes, do it, but don't forget that the thorn by the side of the path or the little grass under your feet is as beautiful and as exquisite as this so-called beautiful flower that you want to explore. The sunset is amazing, amazing, but what about the non-sunset? Isn't that amazing also? If there's a cloud across the sky, isn't that as amazing as the sunset? So there is a sense that the whole mindfulness is opening your senses and your awareness to the hue, to the all the poetry and the beauty of this world without having to dive in. Just the sexual act is the place, and it, because that creates an attachment and, if you like, almost an obsession, and you can't have that magic without it. You'll need those conditions for you to feel the magic of life. And the mindfulness will say the magic is everywhere. Listen to the poetry, listen to the song of this blade of grass, of this body. Okay, just, you know, it's right there in front of you all the time. So that would be the answer.
Thank you. Thank you. My last question. I want to take the example for my last question from Israel, since you are living there. Israel is changing in the past 50 years. It's becoming part of the Middle East. There is more and more children and big families, more of the more religious in a specific way of Judaism. Let's focus on the Jewish community and for this question. In your book, you critique religions and way of living when we attached to teachers, that whatever the teacher says, we say, because the teachers say that. Not because we reflect, which is in some ways the opposite of what's happening in some communities in Israel as the ultra-Orthodox. We saw it with the coronavirus, that sometimes there was a conflict between, you know, the medical world and the rabbis, who said, like, but we believe in something. I even think about the Dalai Lama, but that how much he is a teacher and how much he's a figure that people just like. But it maybe teach us, Stephen, that people need some idolatry, some good idolatry, because the pain of life is huge. You critique it in a few times in your book. And I wonder if you can, if we are allowed to critique it, because you are right, it's attachments, but also to say, as you told me at the beginning of our talk about the Israelis and Palestinians, shway, shway, step by step. So it's also okay that some communities, because of the pain, they just want the rabbi sometimes to decide for them because they're too tired. How do we walk here?
Yeah, I think that it's okay. You know, the teaching would say, if belief, when we're talking about really belief here, belief in an authority figure or belief in a teacher, if it's helpful, then go for it. But realize it's only temporary, that the real teacher is your inner truth. Your real teacher is your authentic experience itself, because you can't reach heaven, you know, any other way. You can't reach heaven because someone tells you that heaven is up there and go. You know, it's the only way you can reach heaven is by seeing that heaven exists in deep in your heart, and then you're really there. And no one else can do it for you. No Messiah can do that for you. But on the way, it is possible. But I would say that the key is in a text called the Kalama Sutta, where the question is, how do we find an authentic teacher? And the answer is, listen, see if the teaching really is helpful, beneficial, kind, and authentic, and that when you try it out, it gives you a real genuine help on the way, and then go for it. So check it out and check out your teacher. Don't automatically believe what your teacher says, or your rabbi, or your priest, or your Buddhist monk. Don't automatically believe. Check it out, authentic, kind, ethical, and wise, and then go for it. And one day you won't need it anymore, but for the moment you can go for it. Temporarily, it's all right.
Thank you. So as we will say goodbye, I want to mention that your book that we are speaking, that was written in Hebrew, and it's called Erut. You also publish it in English, right, for our English speakers. Can you say a few words about that translation, and does it still hold all this beauty that we have in the Hebrew version?
Yes, it does. It's a direct translation. It's called What's Beyond Mindfulness? Waking Up to This Precious Life. So it has the Hebrew title is Erut. It means waking up in daily life. So the subtitle of the book, what's my book in English, What's Beyond Mindfulness, is Waking Up to This Precious Life. And I have it here in front of me. And it's got some really good recommendations from leaders in the mindfulness movement here on the cover of John Kabat-Zinn, who is in a way one of the key people, said it's a deeply illuminating book. It was kind comments from many of the leaders in the field. So it's published by Watkins, and of course available on Amazon, etc. What's Beyond Mindfulness is the English language. The Hebrew one, I must say, has been an amazing success in Israel, a small country, but 18,000 people bought the book, and it's number one bestseller 18 weeks in the list of the instructional books. Which I was really delighted about. And it means that the message is getting out there and people appreciate it.
Oh, it's so needed in Hebrew. I was lucky, real lucky to read it. And, you know, it spoke the language that I think for many Israelis and Palestinians, it's like it's in a way in our language. And you did the translation in such a beautiful way. Stephen, thank you so much for coming to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you, Yakir. It was great. Enjoyed it.